let's go ahead and have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:36 on the afternoon of Wednesday, March the 16th, 2011. We're here today on one matter, and that's the confirmation hearing for the Attorney General, Mr. John Burns, who's here in front of us, and I welcome you to the committee. I'll just begin by saying that this hearing, for some reason, is making me feel old. This is my ninth year in the legislature. This is the sixth Attorney General confirmation hearing that I'm going to participate in. And I can't help but point out that before this, I guess I would just have to say run of Attorney Generals, we'd had an Attorney General who served for 8 years through two terms, Mr. Botello, and that's looking more and more remarkable all the time. I hope that you're, I hope you serve a long time, Mr. Burns. I hope that you occupy the office and do well. I just think there's some benefit to a lengthier tenure in this job than we've seen over the past few years. I know that's none of your doing. I'm just pointing it out as we're getting started. I've sent you some questions a couple of days ago just to give you some framework about what I was interested in. I know other members will have questions. I encourage them all to jump in when necessary. I'll let you sort of get started by introducing yourself and work yourself through any statements you want to give to the committee on the topics as you see them. And I'll just say welcome to the committee and put yourself on the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize to everybody in advance. I'm overcome, and I think I'm on the downhill side of a very bad two-day flu bug. So I apologize for sniveling and coughing through it. It is a pleasure to be appearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee this afternoon. As you are aware, I am the Attorney General designee. It's a position I did not seek, but one that I am very humbled and honored to fulfill. As an Alaskan of 51 years, I share with each of you a commitment to Alaska and a sincere desire to meaningfully contribute to the betterment of this great state. My roots, like many of yours, run deep in Alaska. I grew up first in Nome, where I gained a great appreciation and awareness for life in rural Alaska and had the incredible fortune of spending a great deal amount of time in villages such as Diomede and King Island with my father, who at that time was a marine mammal biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. From Nome, my family migrated to Fairbanks in approximately 1970, and where I've resided since, although I spent a great deal of time during the summer months of high school, college, and law school, working with the Fish and Game throughout Prince William Sound and throughout most of the villages in western Alaska. I'm a graduate of the University of Alaska in Puget Sound School of Law, and for the past 25 years, I've been an attorney in private practice specializing predominantly in business law, commercial litigation, and insurance defense. I've also served for many years as an adjunct professor of business law at the University of Alaska, something I enjoyed very, very much. I'm married to an incredibly patient and understanding woman, and together we have two daughters. During the past nearly 3 months, since my appointment, in addition to spending time in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau meeting and working with department personnel, I've also taken the opportunity to travel to Bethel, Nome, and Barrow to meet with rural leaders, judges, law enforcement officials, and to visit women's shelters and youth facilities with the intention of better understanding the needs of rural communities and how the Department of Law can better meet those needs. My objective as Attorney General is very simple, and I've stressed this to each of you during the separate times that I've had the pleasure of meeting with you. That objective is to uphold the Constitution and to enforce the laws of the state of Alaska, and to do so with dignity, integrity, and consistent with my ethical obligations. I look very forward to a long tenure as the Attorney General, and I'm open to any questions that the panel may have. I'm happy to go through these sequentially if the panel would like. I was told that no written responses were necessary. But
Correct. Now let's just take a second. I think I actually forgot at the very beginning to notice that Senator McGuire was here, that Senator Pascan is here, that Senator Coghill is here, Senator Wilikowski has joined us, and myself, Senator French, so we do have a quorum. We don't have to take these each one in order. I just give them to you as sort of jumping off points conversation, but why don't we go ahead and go back to law school and just maybe tell me how, as a son of a marine biologist, you decided to go to law school and what you thought of your experience and what you did there.
Yeah, much to my father's chagrin at the time, I think he wanted me to pursue biology, and I decided to go to law school. It's something, for some reason, it's something I always wanted to do. For me, I thoroughly enjoyed law school. Looking back on it, particularly.
Did you go straight out of undergraduate, or did you take some time off?
No, I went straight out. I went immediately from one to the other. Particularly in retrospect, when you look at it, the first year, not so much, because you're all trying to find your way through it, and the worry about not making the grades, that sort of thing. But once through the first year, then it became very enjoyable, because it's the pursuit of knowledge for pure knowledge's sake. The ability to theorize about cases, the ability to spend lots of endless hours talking with your cronies about esoteric issues, and not constrained by responsibilities that as you obviously grow older in life, you gain. And so it was a fun time in retrospect. From law school, I did not work during law school with any law firms. My desire was to come back to Alaska to work in law, but I thoroughly enjoyed the marine mammal biology things. I had the opportunity to continue working with fish and game, and I felt like I had the best of all worlds. I spent a lot of time in places like Scammon Bay and Hooper Bay, fishing for, we were doing test fishing for herring. I got to travel up and down the Yukon and the Kuskokwim Rivers, visiting the villages and doing what at that time was subsistence surveys with fish and game as a fisheries technician. And, Prince William Sound, you can't say enough about Prince William Sound, particularly on those days that are beautiful. So I didn't want to give it up, but because I knew once I started down the path of law, I was totally committed to it, and that's exactly what happened. After law school, I had an extended externship during the last part of law school, and extending beyond law school, I had an externship with Justice Rabinowitz on the Supreme Court, and then following that, I worked as a Superior Court clerk in Fairbanks, which at that time there were four judges, and so you clerked in a pool. So I had the benefit of working with and under the tutelage of four judges, which, from a practical experience, was tremendous—a tremendous asset, because you got to understand the rule of law at play, the procedures, the court procedures, and what the judge is looking for, because the judges want, they want things succinctly put, they want it to be credible, and its volume doesn't matter, and so it was a tremendous experience. And from there, it was with Birch Horton, at the time, I think we were between 35 and 45 attorneys. And as many large firms, and from Alaska standards, that was a fairly large firm where there were financial issues that come into play. There's a bit of an implosion. It was very amicable. First, at that time, Birch Horton had Washington, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and D.C. offices. Juneau was the first to leave, and then my partner and I, Corey, also left the mothership, so to speak, and we formed Borgeson and Burns in Fairbanks, continuing. It was a wonderfully amicable disassociation. I retained many, many longstanding friends from Birch Horton, and that's been the career. For 25 years, I worked in private practice and have thoroughly enjoyed it. I've never worried about money, because my philosophy is, if you do a good job, the pay is there. And my focus has always been just that, being the best lawyer I can be, and working every day to get better. So that gives you, in a nutshell, law school and also my private practice years.
Have you taken cases, about how many jury trials have you done, and have you taken cases to the Alaska Supreme Court or to the Ninth Circuit?
I've never had any case go to the Ninth Circuit. I've had, I believe, four cases before the Alaska Supreme Court of varying types. My practice was never something that really, we did a lot of trials. Mr. Pascoe and I have been adversaries in numerous cases, but I don't know that we've ever had a case that went to trial. I probably had six to ten full jury trials. Most of the cases that I did were motion practice, predominantly motion practice or appellate or for appeals for administrative agencies. And my philosophy is if you end up in a trial, if all parties have lost. And so I seek always to dialogue, and to the extent that settlements can be achieved, that is the objective.
Sure. Probably one of the more difficult questions for attorney generals to answer is, who do you work for? It's always a delicate balance answering that question. I see it as a dual role. You have two bosses. You have a governor boss and you have a people boss. Mm-hmm. And how do you reconcile that tension between those two bosses?
Well, my responsibility is clearly laid out in the statute. I am, as you noted, I am the attorney for the governor. But at the same time, I am the attorney for the state of Alaska. My responsibility, first and foremost, is to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the state of Alaska. So that is my guiding principle. And it matters not who my boss is. What matters is that I always and consistent within those requirements, and that's how I view my role, and that's how I intend to execute my duties.
And why don't we turn ahead now to the two basic divisions that you supervise, the civil division and the criminal division. You've worked quite a bit in the civil arena. Why don't we start there? What do you see as the biggest challenge facing the civil division? What do you plan to do in reaction to those challenges?
I came out of private practice, and I was when I came to the Department of Law, I can't tell you enough how fortunate the state of Alaska is to have the quality of attorneys that we do, not simply in the civil, but in the criminal department as well. We have attorneys that are very dedicated. The concept that these are, you know, 8 to 4:30 employees is, I can assure you, is not the case. I am regularly copied on pleadings and communications late into the night, on weekends. They are a very dedicated, hardworking group of employees, which leads me to one of the concerns that, the primary concern that I see with regards to the Department of Law generally, and that is that we have a with no due respect or disrespect, we have an aging workforce. Our attorneys, I think it's 25 to 30%. I think it's about 25% paralegals and attorneys are eligible currently for retirement. Right? And you know, the Department of Law provides really one thing, and that's brain power. And when these individuals, who have such incredible depth of knowledge and institutional memory, leave, we are going to be hurting. And so recognizing that, what we have got to do as a department, and I think the department is doing a good job of that, is to recruit good quality attorneys, to mentor those attorneys, and to pair them up with the aging, soon-to-be retiring attorneys, to get that good mentoring, so that we also have retention and succession planning. These are, I mean, they're critical issues in the Department of Law, and I would venture to assume that's not unique to the Department of Law. It's probably an issue that we, you know, that many of the other agencies face.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and through the chair, I'm going to have to leave it to go to the Finance Committee, so I wanted to get a question in, and just first a thank you very much. I had a chance to talk with John Burns, as all of us did in our office, and as is customary prior to these to confirmation hearings, to really ask more detailed questions, and he set that up at his own initiative, and I want to say thank you for that. You know, it's a big deal. He was definitely tapped. He was earning a nice living in Fairbanks in Joe's backyard there, have a great wife and a great life, certainly, and got an unexpected phone call and rose to the call of duty to serve our state, and I think that speaks highly of you. It wasn't something that you were campaigning for or sought out, but when called, you rose to the occasion to serve our state. I think that the position of Attorney General is clearly one of the most important positions in our state. It's a position of honor and duty, and of course you can expect this committee places a lot of trust in the position, and I believe you'll serve Alaska well. So I will say in advance that you have my support. The question that I have for you today is along the lines of resource development. And I'd like to hear just briefly from you your plan as we look forward to our destiny in the next 50 to 100 years. It's clear that the framers of our Constitution and those who gave us, in fact, statehood, believed that Alaska's future economically would be secured in the ability to develop our resources. In that, we were given land and the ability to develop those subsurface rights. Even our framers recognized that by keeping those subsurface rights held in common for the people, and by extension, the public budget. We've had some difficulty lately. We've had difficulty through the years, to be fair, through different administrations. But in particularly recent years, we've kind of come to this apex where production is down in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline to 625,000 barrels. We had a setback in NPRA in the ConocoPhillips lease with a ruling that came out regarding a bridge over the Colville River. We have got an Outer Continental Shelf lease, series of leases there in the Chukchi and the Beaufort, as you know, by Shell, and now an EPA ruling that's been challenged. We've got a series of land that, frankly, is controlled by the federal government and litigation that's out there pending. I want to know from your perspective, I suspect you've had time now to think about your role as the state's attorney general, and I truly believe you're not the governor's attorney general, you are the state's, for the people of Alaska. What will be your mission when you think about resource development and the backdrop of those regions and how we're going to fill that pipe up, how we're going to get gas to market, how we're going to develop our other rich minerals, the rare earth minerals and things that we have? What will be your mission as attorney general of this state?
First of all, thank you for the comments and the support. It's been a pleasure. In about the 3 months that I've been here, I've had the opportunity to meet with, I believe, 59 of the members. One member was unexpectedly rerouted as a result of TSA's involvement, so that's the only one that I have not met with. But it's been very enjoyable to meet with all of you, and I've appreciated the time and the sincere comments. With respect to the issue of resource development, it is my hope and dream that the rights and privileges of the statehood compact can be achieved. The unfortunate reality, though, is that we have had significant issues of late in achieving those objectives, and litigation simply is not the answer. I think the governor emphasized that in his State of the State address. Litigation should be the last resort. What we have got to do, and we have got to do it very aggressively and proactively, is to dialogue. The frank reality of it is the state of Alaska, much of the state of Alaska, is owned by the federal government. But that does not entitle the federal government to simply lock it up as a preserve. The responsibility of the state of Alaska, my responsibility as Attorney General, will be to try to dialogue, because I'm a firm believer, and I think, and hopefully Senator Pascavan can attest to this, I'm a firm believer that dialogue achieves a lot more than litigation. There's a saying that you attract more with honey than with vinegar. And so our responsibility is going to have to be to dialogue with the federal government to the extent that we can, to be proactive with other stakeholders, the tribes, Native organizations, as I have sought to do. I've been to Barrow twice and have had very good meetings with Mayor Itta and Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. I think that's attested to by the fact that There was a very, it was an enjoyable, but I think very informative meeting in front of the House Finance Committee that Representative Stoltz set up, which had Mayor Itta, Mr. Rock, as president of Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Dan Sullivan, and myself in attendance. And we discussed these issues and the recognition that we've got to all work cooperatively, work together. I just had the privilege of coming back from NAG, the National Association of Attorney Generals. These were issues that were discussed, the necessity of dialoguing cooperatively, working in tandem to try to achieve results. Part of that meeting also entailed a meeting, albeit with the Western Attorney Generals, with Secretary Salazar and some of his his deputies, and we talked about these issues. And so, to be candid, it's going to be dialogue. It's going to be seeking common grounds with other stakeholders, and litigation is a last resort. But please recognize that litigation must always be an arrow in the quiver, and we must be willing to pull that arrow from the quiver when it is necessary to protect our interests as a state. Because the future of our state is critically dependent on resource development, responsible resource development, not resource development at the sacrifice of other resources. And so you can be assured that I will do whatever I can, whatever is within my power, consistent with the Constitution and the laws of the state of Alaska, to achieve the rights and privileges that we were promised under the Statehood Compact.
Great. Thank you.
You mentioned, going back to the Civil Division, you mentioned an aging workforce. What do you see changing that aging workforce? What can you offer that aging workforce, or what can you offer us in the ways of telling us that you'll have a more, a younger workforce?
I can't promise you that, we are going to have a younger workforce. And, a younger workforce is not what we're seeking to achieve. What we're seeking to achieve is a good, solid workforce, a workforce that, like the workforce that we have, very competent attorneys that are dedicated to their job, attorneys that value and have a great work ethic. And so what we will continue to do is to recruit, we will mentor, and we will, to the best that we can within the confines of the public sector, retain those good lawyers. But most of all, we need to work through that succession plan. And one of the things that, I think there's a lot to be said to having new blood come in periodically to take a candid assessment of things and to push and prod a little bit more. For example, I think it's very important to have mentoring. From my perspective, you simply don't throw young lawyers out to the wolves at their, at their first trials and let them flounder about. That doesn't do society good. It doesn't do any good for them. And so what we need to make sure is that we work on developing that mentorship, and we are. Training, good quality, continuing legal education, another project that we're trying to implement, not on a catch-as-catch-can basis, but on a systematic process where we bring in NIDA programs, where some intense work-related educational programs, and that our attorneys can really get the benefit of going through those that type of training, as opposed to just, here's the file, have at it. And so those are the things that we are implementing. And the other thing, candidly, is accountability. The unfortunate reality is that we really have not kept statistics as to win-loss records, that sort of thing. And I want to emphasize, because I'm certain that there are a number of Department of Law employees that may be watching gavel to gavel. Statistics, are not intended just to be kept to know win-loss records, that sort of thing. Statistics are wonderful mentoring tools, because they help you to learn you know, they help the those in roles of responsibility and leadership to analyze and to more closely target mentoring obligations and opportunities. So those are things that we're seeking to work on and to implement. So it's an ongoing process.
Let's just stop and take a moment. The reason we're here in this room today is because Senator Betty Davis was kind enough to give us her committee room. This is the Judiciary Committee. In case anyone is watching or here in the room and is looking for the Hess Committee, that's meeting over in the Belts Room. So just one little area of housekeeping I probably should have addressed earlier. You mentioned a graying workforce in the Civil Division. It may be that the opposite attaches to the Criminal Division, where we get maybe too much turnover, too much of a young workforce, where it's hard to keep experienced prosecutors, courtroom prosecutors, past the fourth, fifth, or sixth year of their time in the Criminal Division. What do you perceive turnover as a problem in the Criminal Division? If so, what actions do you intend to take in that area?
First of all, I want to clarify a misstatement to the extent that I made one. It's not a comparison between civil and criminal. I've been incredibly impressed with the district attorneys in the Criminal Division. These are they are truly in the trench lawyers. They are line lawyers who work to promote justice day in and day out. And we are very fortunate that we have some very, very good district attorneys. After having received the series of questions, I did have the opportunity to talk with Rick Sabodney, who's the deputy who is in charge of the Criminal Division, about turnover. And I'm happy to report that turnover is below the national average as relates to district attorneys. For me, it's never good to ever lose a good attorney. I mean, I would prefer never to do that. But the reality is most attorneys graduating come out of school with $150,000 debt. The best training that an attorney can get is offered by the state of Alaska. These individuals, whether they end up practicing in civil or criminal arena, they get immediate trial experience, and they get good mentoring. They have the opportunity to develop skills on somebody else's nickel. And you know, the reality is, in 5 to 7 years, the opportunities financially are significantly different. And unfortunately, in the public sector, we're not able to meet those salaries, and understandably, many of them move on. Not much that we can do about that, other than ensure that we cultivate an atmosphere that is conducive to always promoting good quality work, that the morale remains high, and the nature of the work is varied and enjoyable. And that's what we seek to do. And I wish I could say that the turnover rate was nil in that department. It's the reality of it, though.
Senator Passman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to the committee. It's interesting statistic when one talks about 25% currently eligible to retire, and there will be a transfer of knowledge, and at that point in time, those new employees will be the most valuable new employees to the state. And at some point in time, I think it will be important for you to think about the golden handcuffs that will keep those new recruits there, so you can preserve that institutional knowledge. So the question is that, how does that occur? And, not needing an answer now, but I think that is going to be one of the challenges to come up with the golden handcuffs that will keep your workforce with you for years to come. So just as a
And I assure you that is one of the many issues that the committee that we have formed to evaluate that has, that's one of the things that they're looking into. How do we retain?
Senator Walikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if you want to take questions now on different topics or if you want to just keep rolling along on this topic. I had some questions on some different areas.
That's fine.
Attorney General, welcome.
Thank you.
I've appreciated the opportunities that we've had to talk, and I have a number of different questions. I guess I'll start off since the question was raised on resource development. Can you give us, to the extent you can, without going into any sort of privileged information, or, how involved are you in the Point Thompson negotiations? And there is some concern by BP and Conoco that they're being left out of those negotiations, and some concern among legislators about the state going ahead and trying to resolve this litigation after this field was sat undeveloped for 30 years. To the extent you feel comfortable or you can you give us an update on that?
I am happy to. I can assure you that the Department of Law is intimately involved in ongoing negotiations. We are aware of the concerns raised by other producers as to participation. Those issues are being addressed. The substance and the specifics of the ongoing settlement discussions obviously must remain privileged and confidential while we're continuing to work through it. But they are issues that are being discussed, and any resolution, I assure you, will be focused on the best interest of the state of Alaska in assuring that there is resource development.
I could, Mr. Chair. This has been an extremely contentious issue over the years, as you know. You do have four-sevenths of the Resources Committee on this committee, and to the extent that we, the legislators on either judiciary or resources or others could be brought in to have an update, a status update, whether it's confidential or not, I would certainly appreciate that, just to see where we're headed as a state, because I think that issue has cascading effects on how we deal with oil and gas leases on the North Slope and Cook Inlet. I know you and I have discussed my concerns about the duty to produce and the fact that I'm very concerned that there are leases on the North Slope that have been issued that have not been produced. And I think when we talk about resource development, we certainly want carrots. We have many carrots with incentives and tax credits and tax breaks. But if we have producers who are not developing those leases simply because they choose not to develop them or simply because they can get a slightly greater rate of return somewhere else, when our leases require them to develop them, that's a great concern to me. And is that something, I know I've asked you when we met several months ago to look into that issue. Is that an issue that you have looked into?
I can assure you that we are continuing to evaluate the issues that you have raised, and I will see what can be done about providing an overview in a confidential setting to the Resource Committee.
Other areas, Mr. Chairman? The issue of tribal sovereignty, if you could take a minute to give us your thoughts on that. When your predecessor came and testified before us, there were a lot of questions regarding a case, Caltag. I suspect you're somewhat familiar with it. It was a very contentious case. The tribal courts had issued a decision. The state later on disagreed with that decision and intervened in that case. And if you could just give us your general philosophy on tribal courts and tribal sovereignty and the Caltag case as well.
Probably the best way to characterize these sorts of issues in many issues generally is that sometimes the best decisions are decisions that are made by a court. Sometimes a court needs to define issues that have major political overtures and that sort of thing. Because Tanana was the segues nicely into that issue. Tanana provides a modicum of clarity, okay, from the standpoint of concurrent jurisdiction on the part of tribes to deal with you know, child proceedings or tribal children proceedings, okay, through tribal courts. Now, as a result of that decision, okay, it provides an incredible opportunity to the state of Alaska and to the tribal organizations to work cooperatively to address some of the procedures that are necessary to ensure that the best interests of the of tribal children are protected, while at the same time addressing some of the other questions that were not answered by Tanana, and those questions related to jurisdiction over non-members, jurisdiction over a non-consenting member, and other due process issues. You know, for example, full faith and credit, where due process wasn't provided in a tribal court setting. These are all issues that were not addressed in Tanana, but issues that clearly need to be addressed in the context of ongoing dialogue with tribal organizations. And I can assure you, in fact, I've already been involved in the ICWA MOU prior to Tanana ever coming out. And so I can assure you that I personally am engaged on that issue and will continue to be. But from my perspective, Tanana provides a wonderful opportunity to the state of Alaska and tribal organizations to sit down and try to address those issues. Some issues.
Let me just ask a follow-up on Tanana while you're on the subject. Do you see that case as offering, or do you see your department in reaction to that ruling, crafting new guidelines for the state with respect to the positions it takes in ICWA cases?
I think the decision itself mandates that be done. How it's going to be done remains to be seen, because it certainly can't be done without a good dialogue amongst the tribal organizations and the state. But it's something that has to be addressed, whether in the context of the Supreme Court reinstituting the China Commission or Committee, or the state working in conjunction with the 12 nonprofit organizations. The framework of it obviously needs to be clarified, but you know, I think all parties recognize the need to get on that quickly, because we need to be prepared as decisions come down. I mean, under what circumstances full faith can be appropriate, those sorts of things, because you have the parallel in the critical concern of due process rights. And, you know, we've got to make certain that due process rights are protected. So I look forward to working with tribal organizations to address those issues.
Let me touch on a couple other rural issues while we're on rural legal issues, and those are the Kasaili case and the Moore case, both dealing with school funding, both long simmering sore spots, I guess I'd have to say, with respect to the relationship between the state and rural education advocates. What perspective you bring to the matter? What advice are you giving the governor with respect to what the state needs to do to come into compliance with those two cases?
Well, I can tell you that I am very aware of both cases. They've been going on, as the chair acknowledged, for a number of years. I believe Kasaili since 1997. Kasaili deals with the issue of the funding, school construction funding. Moore, on the other hand, since 2004, and that deals with the state's obligations under the, to provide quality education. We are, the Department of Law, continuing to engage in dialogue. I've just recently had communications with the plaintiff's attorney in both those matters. We've exchanged correspondence and communication. We're seeking to do mediation coupled with a master, to the extent that a mediation can't be achieved, but a master who can facilitate an ultimate resolution through the court if mediation is unsuccessful. So those are, I'm aware of those issues. I would love nothing more than to bring closure to issues that have, been perpetuated for a number of years. In the final analysis, though, particularly with regards to Kasaili, the resolution of that depends on money. And that issue is not my province. That issue ultimately is yours to decide. And so those are, the framework of the settlement is certainly something I my department will be involved in. So I hope I've answered your questions succinctly.
Don't see any. Senator Passman.
Sure. Part of the rural issues are focused upon the trail issues, the 2477 issue, and would like to hear your comments on the state's position on intervening for purposes of establishing a 2477 access.
Yeah, all of you are no doubt aware, the state of Alaska has just sent a notice of intent relative to 2477s. It's a it's a very interesting situation. The state of Alaska years back probably had a far easier time to achieve 2477s than now. The federal government has taken the position that you must prove up on a 2477 almost every inch of the way. Now, the consequence of that is that what the department must do in conjunction with Department of Natural Resources is to prioritize what 2477 opportunities are there, which actually will lead to something. Just to achieve a 2477 for the purposes of 2477 at the cost that's associated with that doesn't make much sense. So it's a matter of prioritizing, and then it's a matter of identifying in those within that priority list that have the most chance of success. Because what you don't want to be doing is just chasing 2477 designations at tremendous expense for no reason. And so that's what we are engaged in. It's a collaborative effort between the Department of Law and Department of Natural Resources to do just that. And I'm happy to say that that is proceeding.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Slightly different topic. Just going back to your background and can you talk a little about who the clients you've had over the years, who you've represented, and who you any conflicts that you might anticipate as Attorney General?
I have been very privileged to have represented a long list of clients that have ranged from corporations to individuals. It's just been my I look back in 25 years and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. They have ranged from doctors to individual business owners to mom and pop entities. So my list of clients obviously was filed in my APOT report. I can list names if you'd like, in my recollection, but I can assure you that my list of clients was given to our Department of Law, who then went through that list and is making certain that there is no conflict on any case. To the extent that there is a conflict, then I am effectively walled off from any communication or any involvement. And so I don't see that there will ever be a situation of conflict.
Just work for any, major oil companies?
No, I've done, in the past, I believe I was involved with MAPCO. It was a borough tax issue matter, but I haven't represented any.
Exxon, BP, Conoco, no. And Native Corps, ANGSA,
Tanana Chiefs. Mm-hmm. I've represented Tanana Chief, and again, predominantly in business-related transactions, purchasing, buildings, assisting with contract reviews, and that sort of thing. And to a certain extent, Doyon, represented Doyon in similar situations. So.
Further questions? Senator Wilkowski, sure.
Sure. When we met, talked a little bit about consumer protection and price gouging. The Attorney General has been involved in that issue of gasoline price gouging over the years. Have you had an opportunity to look at the reports filed by the Attorney General. Do you have any suggestions for legislation or ideas on how we can deal with the fact that we have we're not number one in the country in terms of our gasoline prices? We're number three now. Many of us believe that there has been price gouging over the years by refiners, and some of us would like to see laws in place to put a halt to that. Do you have any opinion on those laws or opinion on whether or not there is legal or illegal price gouging occurring in Alaska?
Well, I have read the reports that you were referring to. I believe you're referring to the one that the Attorney General's office conducted, and then I believe there's a subsequent ICER report that was issued. And the result of it is that they could find that there was no invalid or illegal activity, that it was simply the vagaries of the market, particularly as relates to rural Alaska. And as such, there was no action taken. I can assure you that the Consumer Protection Division of the Department of Law advocates very strongly for consumer rights. So we have a very good department. They are wonderfully successful in their endeavors, as I believe, I made very clear in the overviews that I've given. I do not have any particular recommendations for any legislation dealing with the issue, because at this juncture, even though the prices appear to be high, it's little consolation that we're third. There's nothing tangential that would substantiate that there's price gouging.
Different set of questions. if you could just talk a little bit about TSA, and I heard an interesting argument the other day that if TSA were to start conducting the sort of pat downs in Alaska, that could very likely be unconstitutional under our Constitution because we have the privacy provision. Is that something you've looked into? Do you agree with that, disagree with that? There's a lot of concern among Alaskans about the procedures within TSA.
I'm aware, particularly in light of the most recent incident that happened to one of your colleagues. I have not looked into that, and it is something that our department will be looking into, and I will certainly, when that analysis is concluded, I will certainly make a point to touch bases with you.
Another slightly different area. Do you have any just philosophy question? One of the issues that comes up on a regular basis is whether or not we should be electing our Attorney General. And just curious to hear your – I expect I know what your opinion is on that as a appointed Attorney General, but
You'd actually be surprised because, initially I hadn't given it any thought whatsoever. I mean, the role of Attorney General is something that I was aware of. You know, as far as I was concerned, it was just another attorney. You know, it was not until I was asked to assume this role that I really started to question and to seek to understand what the controversy or the issue really is. I see benefits for both sides. The presumption from the elected position is that individual will be more in tune with the public, more representative of the public. Now, what's interesting to me, having just come from NAG, National Association, terrible name, but National Association of Attorney Generals, Alaska is one of four states that appoints, so all others are elected. It flabbergasted me to know the cost of those elections.
Right.
$1.5-2 million is not an unreasonable number. I would prefer that our Attorney General be impartial to the politics of law, that the Attorney General is someone who holds the highest regard for the law, is not susceptible to the political pressures that come with elective office. And so not because I'm appointed, but because I think it serves the best interests of the state of Alaska, the citizens of the state of Alaska, to assure that their representative is somebody who is most concerned with doing the right thing under the law, less concerned about, is this the right thing for me?
Interesting side note. In territorial days, we elected our attorney general. It's just an interesting change we made when we went through statehood. Senator Cockhill.
Just an observation on that. We all tend to agree with you when it's the attorney general we want. I do have a question, though, Mr. Chairman. You know, with the sexual assault and the criminal behavior in Alaska, application of law is something that we've dealt with in this committee a lot. And through the years, we've tried to get tough on certain areas. But in the conversation of getting tough on areas, as somebody who hasn't practiced in the field, and I'm the only one on the committee right now that doesn't, it's always close to alarming to me how many cases are bargained. And sometimes, to me, it looks like more like a dollar figure than it does an actual charge of it. So that's one question I have. And then the other question that follows along that is, in the outlying areas, actually even in the Fairbanks areas, misdemeanors are not handled very thoroughly. And that looks like a cost issue, too. And because of the outlying areas that I live in, if you do not catch somebody on a misdemeanor, the only way to really get them is to go to a felony. And it looks like we're turning only felons into what I'd say regular application of the law. So is my concern unjustified, or is that something that you've noticed, or do I only see one part of the picture?
With regards to the latter question, the it's a matter of resources. You know, we try to prioritize those matters that have you know, most urgency, greatest risk of harm, these sorts of things, and so we simply don't have the manpower, if you would, to address all of those issues. We try to prosecute as many misdemeanors and felonies as is possible to prosecute. With regards to the former question on sexual assault and domestic violence, I assure you that our department is very aggressive relative to that issue. It's a it certainly is an issue that I'm passionate about. It's an issue clearly that the governor is passionate about, and it's an issue that this legislature is very passionate about. Every case is evaluated on a case-by-case basis. You have to have the facts upon which you can justify a prosecution. Some of the cases are pled down because the facts don't substantiate fully, and the risk involved with going forward on that type of a case may not warrant. And so there's always a case-by-case analysis. But I can assure you that sexual assault and domestic violence is a priority of the department, you know, we will continue to make it so.
Mr. Chairman, just on that account, I was the police have discretion on charging, and it looks like the Department of Law has some discretion on how they will move forward on those, and then judges have a huge discretion on how they will manage those. So I see a lot of discretionary movement before somebody actually gets held accountable for a crime. So that means there's a lot that don't even get a policeman at the front door or at the place where the action's taking place. And, you know, that's one of the things that I will watch as we go through our legislative budgeting process. But do you see a disparity, or have you even heard in your looking into the department, between what police are actually charging and what you're actually able to substantiate? Are we doing a good enough job of, say, instructing police in the law to apply that law? Or do we, is that what the pleading part is? Or is it just that the resources on discovery and I'm kind of trying to figure out in my mind, the tougher we get, it seems like the more resources that go into it, we're going to go down to where stealing a stick of chewing gum is going to be a felon pretty soon.
You bring up a very interesting dilemma. As I noted in my opening remarks, since assuming this position, I've been to Bethel, Barrow twice in Nome. I'm going back to Bethel on the 31st. In those meetings, I have the opportunity to meet with rural leaders, judges, law enforcement. The rural leaders in some of those communities have indicated to me that they felt that we were not diligently prosecuting the cases. All right. So as a result of that, let me take Bethel, for example. As a result of that, I am seeking to convene what I call the Bethel Justice Project, which is to bring the stakeholders together to kind of identify what these issues are. Because you talk to the district attorney's office, and the district attorney's office will tell you that, hey, listen, the quality of the report that we are receiving is not really solid. There's too many questions that remain, so I can't take a case like this and be, you know, reasonably sure that we're not going to get thrown out. I have this case over here that's, you know, much, much better. And so my question is, well, are you interfacing with the police? Are you following through with the police department to let them know what further things you need? And, you know, unfortunately, yeah, there's been times where I think that has not happened. And so what we have to recognize is that we are not silos, individual silos. We've got to open up those avenues of communication to dialogue on these particular issues. And that is something that I've really been emphasizing. And, most recently we hired a district attorney to lead the office in Bethel. That had been a position that had been vacant for over a year. In my mind, the district attorney plays a critical role for the Department of Law, because that individual is a representative of the department within the community. That person must get out, must interface with the community, must be the liaison between the Department of Law, right, rural leaders, and the police, so that we have this dialogue going on. And frankly, you know, to the extent there are deficiencies, the Department of Law needs to educate a little bit more. You know, how do we make sure that we're getting the right information? And, you know, we really have to do that with regards to the VPSOs and the VSOs.
Let me just add that I've spoken informally with the Attorney General about this a couple of times. I appreciate your focus and attention to the Western Alaska. If the sex assault rates in the state are high, they're epidemic there. And I think the idea of focusing resources there is an excellent one. I commend you for that. I hope you follow through. I'm sure you will. And I think you're onto something. My own personal belief is that once a case gets accepted by the Department of Law for prosecution, that the bad guy's in bad shape, that something's going to happen to that person negatively that stops his behavior. But that it's upstream of the Department of Law in the field and police work that the greatest amount of good and the greatest degree of gains can be made. Stronger reporting, stronger police work, faster follow-up, more photographs, more evidence. I think you put all those in the hands of Mr. Zabodny's prosecutors, and we'll go a long way towards pushing down the sex assault rates. So I just want to thank you for putting some attention to that specific problem in that part of the state.
Thank you.
There is an Eastern Alaska.
There is an Eastern Alaska. It's closer to the road system, and it seems to benefit from that. But it's a problem in my community. I know it's a problem in your community, too. It's not as if Fairbanks and Anchorage escape these scourges. But when you look at the types of cases that arise in the YK Delta, they just seem to be more serious and come more often.
Mr. Chairman, and the reason I ask the question is when we do our budgets, police work is one of the questions. And understanding the challenges between the prosecution of our, or the handling and prosecution of the law and the application of the law at the first responder level is something that we need to keep the dialogue open on, because I don't know that we always get that.
Let's turn to the last question on my list, and that's the healthcare question. I asked you to be prepared to discuss your advice to the governor, and I guess just to lay out the landscape. I'm talking about the time between when Judge Vinson in Florida ruled on the 31st of January that the Affordable Care Act was unconstitutional. 5 weeks later, he issued a formal stay of his order on the 4th of March. And in between that time, many states were not sure what to do about the Affordable Care Act and their governmental obligations in respect to it. You opined about midway through that time period that the ruling was binding law. I asked for and received a legislative legal memo from Dennis Bailey that largely, I guess I'll just say, was contrary to that perspective. You've had some time to think about it. And so let's turn to you and see what your analysis of that question is at this point in time.
And Mr. Chairman, what I would like to do, because this is I know this is a significant issue to you, I have prepared a statement that I would like to have read into the record, and I think that will hopefully clarify some things. I would also note that in response to Senator Wilkowski's earlier comment, this is one of the other reasons that I think that the state of Alaska benefits from having an appointed attorney general, because I think it's not my role to publicly come forward and respond to issues where there may be a disagreement. I just don't, you know, the dignity of the office, the respect that I have for the legislature and the administration, I have to, you know, make certain that while I may have wanted to publicly have responded to that, it was not appropriate. You know, this is an issue that will be decided by the court, and, you know, it's only the court that's going to be able to resolve that. But in light of the fact that you specifically asked me to respond to that question, I at this juncture would like to take the opportunity to read a very brief statement, and I'm happy to provide a hard copy to the body if they would like.
Sure, read your statement, sure. Please.
Yeah. I mean, the background of your question is that on January 31st, 2011, Judge Roger Vinson of the United States District Court for the Northern District of Florida granted summary judgment to the 26 plaintiffs challenging the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Judge Vinson's order found unconstitutional the individual mandate provision of the Affordable Care Act, which would require that everyone, with certain limited exceptions, purchase federally approved health insurance or pay a penalty. Judge Vinson held that the individual mandate was not severable from the rest of the act, and he therefore declared the entire act void. Alaska was a party. It was a plaintiff in that case. And parties are bound by the court's judgment that the act is void. That's black letter law. As agents of the state, state officials must abide by the decision. For this reason, with due respect to the legislative counsel who prepared the memo, the point that Judge Vinson's order has precedential or stare decisis effect only, quote, in the limited territory of the Northern District of Florida is, in my opinion, incorrect. By filing the lawsuit that it did, Alaska submitted to the jurisdiction of the court and must follow the court's decision. Thus, to the extent that the Affordable Care Act requires any action or implementation by the state of Alaska, it was binding law on the state of Alaska. The state could not challenge or the constitutionality of the act in either state or federal court in Alaska or elsewhere. Now, of course, since that decision, Judge Vinson issued a subsequent decision on, I believe it was March 3rd, issued a stay pending a decision on appeal, so the parties are therefore relieved of the injunctive effect of the decision until the 11th Circuit decides the appeal. And as this body is aware, it is on very expedited appeal. I mean, it's a phenomenal appeal time frame that that I think the 11th Circuit set on. I believe that final briefing is due early May. So, with regards to the three legal principles pointed or noted in the legal's opinion, that opinion stated that they believed the application of the Florida court has stare decisis, res judicata preclusion. Again, with regards to the principles of claim preclusion or issue preclusion, I disagree with the conclusion of Ledge Legal that the Florida District Court decision would not have preclusive effect in another lawsuit between the same litigants pending appeal in this case. District Court decisions are binding on the parties unless a stay pending appeal is granted, and there are a myriad of cases to that effect. An undecided appeal does not otherwise affect a judgment's finality, which is still binding upon the parties while an appellate court reviews that order. The established rule in the federal court is that a final judgment retains all of its res judicata consequences pending decision on the appeal. And again, numerous sites for that. For this reason, I do not concur with the conclusion of Ledge Legal that the Florida District Court decision would not have preclusive effect in another lawsuit between the same litigants pending appeal in this case. And Judge Vinson's clarification order made clear that the parties were legally required to follow the order immediately and that they did not have the discretion to ignore it pending appeal until such time as he issued the stay. As to the doctrine of full faith and credit and the precedential effect of a decision, which were the other points, that the Florida decision is not available for enforcement under the full faith and credit clause and would not have precedential effect in a different federal district or state court in a case between the parties, those statements have no relevance to the Florida Affordable Care litigation. It is clear that the Florida District Court will not have the final word on the constitutionality of the act, as the United States has appealed the case to the 11th Circuit. It is therefore irrelevant whether another court will give full faith or credit to the decision while it is on appeal. The plaintiff states certainly will not attempt to enforce the judgment in a different court while the 11th Circuit or the Supreme Court reviews the district court decision. It is also irrelevant that a decision by one district court is not binding on another. In fact, several district courts have considered the constitutionality of this act and have rendered inconsistent decisions. This is one of the reasons why the issue will likely be decided ultimately by the Supreme Court. The fact that a different court in a different case brought by different parties might decide the case differently does not relieve the parties in this case from the force and effect of the judgment made by the Florida court. So, with due respect, Mr. Chairman, I disagree with the analysis provided to you.
I'll just point out, it occurred to me as I was preparing for this hearing, this was a decision made before you were running the Department of Law, but it just crossed my mind to wonder how it is that the state of Alaska wound up in a courtroom in Florida, in Pensacola, Florida, and why we would even begin to take that step. Why would we submit ourselves to the judgment of a judge in Pensacola, Florida, when talking about the rights and privileges and obligations and reform of health care? It just struck me as an odd decision. I guess sometime I'll ask your predecessor or maybe his boss in a private conversation. But I guess I'll just say before I turn it over to other members that in that 5-week period, only three states, Alaska, Florida, and Wisconsin, took the somewhat extreme view that health care reform was dead. Every other, even plaintiffs to that case, took different perspectives about where their states stood in relationship to the Affordable Care Act. Senator Pascoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, my initial thought was again, why were we in that jurisdiction to begin with? And what I am wondering is what consideration did the state's attorney general's office look to as to the issue of forum shopping?
Yeah, I'm not in a position.
What have you heard internally?
I have not heard anything internally. I'm not in a position to even answer that question. The decision, as the chairman noted, the decision had been made. It was long since filed, and I inherited the office in the position that I did at the time I did.
Senator Willick, follow up?
No.
Senator Willickowski.
Yeah, just a statement, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for you, Attorney General. I do. I've appreciated your candidness and your responses to the questions, but I'm a little surprised by your statements today. And with all due respect, several attorneys in this building disagreed with your position. Legislative Council has now disagreed with your position. The Alaska Supreme Court has come out, and in the analysis done by Legislative Council has disagreed with the general concept that you're proposing. But most importantly, the judge in your case disagrees with your position. And so I'm surprised that you would come in here and take the position that you're taking now, that you, because the decision cost us $1 million, and it may have cost us millions more in the future in lost federal funds. So I guess it's more just a comment than anything else, but I'm just surprised at the position you're taking today, that there was no mistake when, in my opinion, it's very clear, and the judge in the case even disagreed that the case should be is binding at this phase.
And I apologize, but I'm not certain that's what Judge Vinson held. Judge Vinson made it very clear that the decision, the breadth in scope of his decision that was issued on January 31st was intended to be binding on the parties then and there. He subsequently, recognizing the need that this be elevated to a higher body for a decision and ultimately to the Supreme Court, implemented a stay because he said, you know, in his mind, there was a recognition that both parties had a very good argument. And he stayed it conditioned on the Department of Justice expediting its appeal. That has been done, and so, you know, we are moving forward appropriately. And I would just note that there is a difference between implementation, which is a legal question, and funding, which is a policy question.
But the context in which this comes about is we have a decision that's made by a Supreme Court, by a district court judge in Florida, and we as a state are trying to decide whether or not we should apply for federal funding. And the governor came to you for your opinion, and according to the accounts that I've read, relied on your opinion in making the decision not to apply. And I guess in that case, where there's so much case law out there, and the treatises, in my opinion, are very clear, and the Constitution is very clear. I guess why wouldn't you have just erred on the side and said, you know what, it's probably a good idea. Let's just apply for the funds, and then if we get this clarified once and for all, we can always just turn back the funds. I guess that's the problem that I'm having here is. There were so many people saying this decision is not binding on the state of Alaska, and it seems to me that in your position, the proper advice to the governor would have been, well, I guess there could be an argument either way, but the safer thing, because as attorneys we often advise our clients to do what's safe. Did you see no risk at all in losing the millions of dollars?
My responsibility is to provide the best legal advice that I feel appropriate under the circumstances. That was precisely what was done. The issue related to the impact, the effect of Judge Vinson's decision. We were a party to that decision. It would be no different than if this body, in my mind, were to pass a law for the governor to simply say, we're going to ignore it because I think it's unconstitutional. Right, and then for that law to then be appealed to the court, and for a court to find in favor of that law, for the governor to ignore that law pending an appeal. I mean, the responsibility our government is set up you know, in a tripartite system, and due respect for each of those branches of government is necessitated. In this context, the decision of a case in which we were a party was made. And as you can, as I believe is very clear, once Judge Vincent issued the stay, then the question wasn't whether or not to implement, it was that you would implement. And I think the governor has made it very, very clear that he intends to implement at this juncture. Right? We do not know and will not know for some period of time what the 11th Circuit ultimate decision is or that of the Supreme Court. But at this juncture, my understanding is that the governor fully intends to honor his obligation under the law. And that law currently is implementation. And there is a fundamental difference between implementation and funding. I do not make policy decisions relative to funding. I simply pose and answer legal issues, and that relates to implementation.
Senator Coghill.
Many times we in this body have surrendered our ability to manage Alaska based on accepting federal money, so I understand the dilemma. You know, we surrender everybody's Social Security number for welfare benefits in Alaska. I mean, it's just one of those things that we have decided as policy to do. So I understand the dilemma. I, for one, am grateful, though, that the end in sight is to find out whether the Congress can mandate every man, woman, and child take a service or take a penalty, and I appreciate that. So I'm glad that Alaska joined it. The process might be messy. I know that under the Commerce Clause, it puts states with intention, almost good enough reason to go original jurisdiction, in my view. But we have to go through these various different courts, and you could get the Ninth Circuit Court and any other circuit court in America coming up with very, very different conclusions, and they do. And so I think this is a slow, messy way of doing it. I wish we could have gone straight to the Supreme Court, but I don't know that there was a venue to do that. If there was, I would like to know.
Senator Passman.
I think that brings us back to my point, is should the legislature be involved in the policy decision on which jurisdiction the litigation would be filed in for purposes of, you know, because I think there was an element of forum shopping in here. And that's my concern as to whether the legislature should be involved in that, particularly where I think that the concept was, is I believe we were told that the state's monetary exposure was like $5,000 or something. And so here, for effectively a de minimis price, it seems like we've surrendered a tremendous amount of policy control over this area. And so that's the conundrum that I have. That we did surrender ourselves to a jurisdiction in Florida for this de minimis price that we chose. And so I wonder whether we should retain more control over that at the initial stages.
If I may respond, I would certainly advocate not from the standpoint that the decision of in the context of litigation, as you know very well, has a myriad of issues. You weigh all sorts of different issues in making that determination. And if one of those issues is not available to you, then it constrains the dynamics of it. We, as a state of Alaska, are regularly involved in class actions. Right? Well, many of our consumer cases are involved in class actions, so we don't bring in Alaska. Right? It would be cost prohibitive. To the extent that Alaska, that juncture in time when the decision was made, that Alaska felt that it was an unconstitutional provision, it made perfect sense for Alaska to, with the limited resources that the Department of Law has, to most effectively use those resources by joining a class action, an action that had already been filed. And so it made perfect sense under those contexts to join that litigation. And so, you know, it's a balancing of issues. And that issue was there's an ongoing litigation. I'm assuming. I'm just, you know, in because I was not party to the decision matrix, but it makes perfect sense to me in retrospect as to how we may have made that decision.
So we have time to switch to a different subject.
We've got a few more minutes, sure. I think we're about done with that.
Switching to the Endangered Species Acts, and just kind of where do you believe that the state can focus relative to the endangered species law? And it seems to be an issue of increasing importance to Alaska.
And it's an issue of increasing importance, not simply to Alaska, but to many of the other states. Unfortunately, many of the other states are preoccupied with significant budgetary issues. Their focus of the Department of Law is, you know, in addressing the budgetary issues. So although many of the other states that I've talked with have similar concerns and they are willing to join with us because of the what we call the ESA issues, you know, we are going to be, as Alaska, have to be very proactive in bringing those parties along. The Endangered Species Act, like so many regulations, is wonderful in concept. It's the application of the ESA that has become problematic. And, you know, the Department of Law is focusing on addressing as best we can those issues. Unfortunately, it's going to take, not unfortunately, but the reality is it will also require you know, intervention at the federal level through our federal delegation to work towards modulating the effect of what ESA is all about. Because using the example of the stellar sea lion, to digress quickly, I understand that the body's got time constraints, but the stellar sea lion, for example, the problem with ESA when it's coupled with the concept of global warming is that the burden of proof is not to establish that human behavior is causing an effect. It's almost the reverse. We have to effectively establish that human behavior is not causing. And so in the context of the stellar sea lion situation, we have scientific data that establishes that on rookeries and haulouts, the samples from the specimens all show that they're well-nourished, they're healthy stocks, which would indicate that fish, you know, the fish supply is adequate. And yet, the, you know, Marine Fisheries NOAA, National Marine Fisheries and NOAA cannot determine the cause of the decline in some areas. It's not universal, it's just in some random areas. And so what they have chosen to do is to simply say, we don't know, but the only thing in reality that we can affect is human behavior, therefore we close the fishery. And in doing that, you've significantly affected ADAC, you've closed down a fishery, and it's based on science of questionable report. And that's the dilemma that ESA presents. And unfortunately, it's the misapplication of ESA itself.
We have come close to the end of the hour. Let me go ahead and just ask one final wrap-up question, and that is there anything else about you, Mr. Attorney General, or your background or your plans for the Department of Law that we should know before we make this important decision about the state?
No, I think I've laid out as much as there is to know about me. You know, I'm not about accolades. You know, this is the first resume I put together in a lot of years. To me, it's about getting results. It's about doing a good job. And, you know, I'm very privileged to be leading a department that I think is exceptional. And my objective is to ensure that it remains the department that it is and does nothing but get better. And that what our actions are always held to the highest level of integrity, and that we show respect for all parties concerned. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I would solicit a motion. Senator Wilkowski.
Chair, I would move that we forward the appointment to a joint session for consideration.
Is there objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, congratulations, Mr. Burns. Your name will be forwarded on to a joint session of the legislature for a vote before the end of this legislative session. And if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we're adjourned.